Schools sue over opioids, ocean tides spill into neighborhoods, and the health of the sea. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. This week, Miami-Dade County Public Schools sued more than a dozen companies that make or distribute opioids. The district is looking to recoup the money it says it spends on keeping the painkillers out of schools and dealing with the effect on students and families. This week's king tides were some of the highest on record, leading to sunny day flooding and no wake zones on streets. So why were the high tides so high? And how have the efforts to hold back or redirect the water worked? Plus, heat waves underwater, higher seas, and the effect on marine life, the health of the ocean. How important is the ocean to you? Did you drive through a king tide this week? Join us on the South Florida Roundup next on WLRN, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week and supporting public radio. This week, Miami-Dade County Public Schools opened a new front in the battle over prescription painkillers in South Florida. The school district filed a federal lawsuit against more than a dozen companies that make or distribute the medicine. The district argues it should be compensated for money it's been spending on dealing with the opioid crisis. While states and local governments have sued opioid companies, this may be the first lawsuit independently brought by a school district. Now, the Miami-Dade County Public School District is the broadcast license holder of WLRN, but has no editorial control. This is where we begin the South Florida Roundup this week, the opioid crisis and public education. Joining us to talk about the lawsuit, WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman. Also, Politico's Alex Glorioso is with us via FaceTime audio. Jessica, first of all, walk us through the claims in this lawsuit. What is the school district arguing?
Right. So it's a nearly 300-page lawsuit. It was filed in federal court on Monday. And it says that basically the district has lost money and also property value because of the opioid crisis. And I'm looking right now at the list. There's A through K of examples. And a couple of them are, saying that there are costs for providing in-school nursing to students and staff who are suffering from opioid addiction. It says including overdoses and deaths. Also training nurses and school resource officers in how to treat a drug overdose. They said that there are costs associated with law enforcement trying to limit or stop the flow of opioids into schools.
Alex, you cover health policy at the state level in Florida for Politico. What strikes you about this lawsuit coming from the Miami-Dade County Public School District, largest school district in Florida, fourth largest in the nation?
Yeah, this lawsuit is really interesting. It's really similar to the lawsuit that former Attorney General Pam Bondi filed, I think, last May, I believe. And, you know, she had really filed a comprehensive lawsuit that had been long awaited that accused these drug manufacturers and distributors of racketeering and of public nuisance and, you know, essentially moral depravity and, you know, forcing Florida and the legislature to fork over all this money to, you know, sort of treat this societal crisis that they caused by illegal or deceptive marketing.
Yeah.
And that is largely the same lawsuit that the school board filed on Monday. It made, you know, many of the same allegations and said that because it's the fourth largest school board in the nation, it is a kind of government entity. It has, you know, almost 400 schools that it oversees and 40,000 employees. So it has a lot of the same bereavements.
Yeah. And in regards to the employees, Jessica Bakeman, that may be a place in my just general reading, and I'm not a lawyer, clearly just a journalist here, but one of the claims it makes is the increased healthcare expenditures that the school district has had to have because it alleges of the opioid crisis.
Right. And, you know, the lawsuit doesn't get into specifics. It doesn't have a specific dollar amount. This is how much you owe us. It doesn't say this is how much we've spent. These are this number of people who've been affected. So we really don't know that. And you know, this kind of brought this to my attention in a way that I would like to look into it a little bit further. And maybe we can bring WLRN listeners and readers some more information about that in the future. But yeah, as far as, you know, staff members, students, all of these people are affected by the opioid crisis in a way that broader society is being affected. And it's interesting because some of these things, you know, you could probably argue that some of these costs were going up regardless. Like, we know that health costs and health insurance costs have been going up. Personnel, like salaries and benefits, are the highest costs for any school district. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, thinking about law enforcement costs, we've had increasing law enforcement costs since the Parkland shooting and the legislation that followed that, because of these new requirements that there has to be a police officer or an armed guard in every school campus. So I think the school district likely would have been paying more for law enforcement anyway.
Yeah, trying to separate those two out could be part of the discovery of this lawsuit as it makes its way through federal court. Alex Glorioso with Politico. There's another claim in this lawsuit by the school district in Miami that says that the district has had to, quote, make large unplanned for expenditures in order to protect the health and welfare of the community it serves. What do you make of that kind of claim in this kind of lawsuit?
Yeah, that is, I think, the most interesting claim. Jess and I were talking about it a little bit this morning in preparation for the show, but you know, I didn't get into it in my reporting this week, but it seems clear to me that they are referring to diverting, you know, roughly $75 million a year they get in state mental health funding since the Parkland shooting in, I believe, 2017. So it seems to me like they're implying that they're using that money on drug addiction and instead of preventing school shootings. And I thought that was really interesting. It just, it, you know, it wasn't straightforward enough for me to include it on Deadline, but that is sort of the way that I read it.
Right. And the Parkland shooting was February 14th, 2018. Mm-hmm. And, you know, shortly after that, the legislature passed this huge law. And then in the following legislative session, they passed another one and it put so many more requirements on schools. It did include additional funding for mental health services, although a lot of people think that, you know, it's not enough and it may not be consistent, you know, going into the future. But that's another interesting point that Alex raises as well. Like we were talking about with law enforcement. Okay, are you really spending more on mental health services for students who've been affected by the opioid crisis, or is it related to the shooting? Or maybe, as Alex was saying, maybe we might find out that money that was intended to be, you know, making sure that students are in good mental health and they're, you know, in order to try to prevent a tragedy like what happened in Parkland, you know, are they diverting that to address this crisis instead? So I think this raises a lot of really interesting and important questions. And given the fact that this is such a big school district doing this, and these questions are probably really relevant all over the country, even Parkland. I mean, Parkland created a lot of change in a lot of school districts all over the country. So it's definitely something for us to keep a close eye on, and it could set some precedents in terms of this lawsuit.
Yeah, how noteworthy is it that the it's a school district here taking this action? As Alex mentioned, the state of Florida has had a lawsuit. We've had county governments and local municipal governments file lawsuits, if not at least debate lawsuits. But here we are, a major government entity. A school district, major employer, major property tax base collector as well, filing this lawsuit.
Right. I mean, this is a local government that just as the school district itself, not thinking about the city or the county, is bigger than a lot of other local governments throughout this state. And, you know, I can't really say for certain it is the first and only school district that is sued. We know that some other school districts have joined on to lawsuits with other entities. But it appears that it's the first. And regardless of that, you know, the fact that it is so big, I think that it's really drawing attention to this is how this crisis, which we think of as a health crisis, which we may think of as a crisis that affects the criminal justice system, how it really is infiltrating and affecting schools and the lives of students and families.
Alex Glorioso with Politico. Politico. How is this coloring the state case or conversations among state policy makers as they look at this local government entity filing this opioid lawsuit in the environment where we're seeing some of these lawsuits begin to be settled now?
Yeah, well, I think an important sort of distinction here is time. They did not file their lawsuit against Purdue, which is, you know, the company that really created the crisis and that has taken so much heat from many governments.
OxyContin, yes. the manufacturer of OxyContin, which has been identified as kind of the genesis of this crisis.
Yeah, and they're not suing Purdue because Purdue filed for bankruptcy and in order to settle as part of its settlement, I guess, with Florida and several other states. So it's kind of weird. It's like Florida will be soon settling with Purdue. I don't know what's going to happen with its, you know, allegations against other manufacturers and distributors. And now Miami-Dade is going after those other manufacturers and distributors, potentially on its own. So it's just sort of like part one and part two, I guess.
Could this lawsuit get consolidated with all the other local government lawsuits from across the nation?
Yes. They could join with the multi-district litigation, and it's not clear whether that's their intention. I saw on, you know, an old agenda item that they were recommending that, but, you know, it's been several months.
Yeah.
And so I don't know why they've taken so long to file this. I don't know if they are intending to join that lawsuit or if they have an interest in just doing it on their own. I don't know. Jess might be able to add more to that.
I don't have any insight on that, but I did just want to mention one other thing, which is it'll be interesting to see if other school districts follow suit, whether in Florida or across the country. And, you know, looking at the numbers, we know that, you know, Palm Beach County in particular has been especially affected by the opioid crisis. So, you know, maybe Palm Beach County or Broward County, you know, might be interested. So we'll definitely keep an eye on this going forward.
Jessica Bakeman there last speaking, covers education for us here at WLRN. We've been joined by Alex Glorioso, covering healthcare policy at Politico, with us via FaceTime from Tallahassee. Jessica and Alex, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for having us.
Sure thing. We got plenty more to come here on the South Florida Roundup. Parts of the area facing higher levels of king tides this week, the highest high tides of the year, highest we've seen on record in the last several years. What were your experiences? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. King tides next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. It is king tide season in South Florida. Higher than predicted levels of king tide spilled into some neighborhoods across the region this week. Paddle boarders floated across parking lots. Cars drove through no-wake zones, yet driving through no-wake zones on streets. You saw the video and the pictures on social media and elsewhere. Millions of dollars have been spent trying to keep streets dry or move water around. And the king tides will return to put those systems to another test later on this month. So, did you drive through the salt water and then wash the car off right away? Maybe you stopped the car, backed up, and turned around. Tell us your king tide story. Did they come up in your neighborhood? Were you walking or driving or paddling through the water this week, as the case may be? 800-743-WLRN. That's our phone number for the voice calls, 800-743-9576. You could send us a text as well. The text line is 786-786-7636. Again, the text line, 786-786-7636. Text us your name and where you're texting from in South Florida. That would be helpful as well. Brian McNulty is with us now, a researcher in tropical cyclones at the University of Miami, and Jane Gilbert is the chief resilience officer for the city of Miami. To both of you, welcome to WLRN. Jane, welcome back to the roundup as well. Brian, let's start here. Talk about the science. What made these king tides not just high, but much higher than predicted, according to the tide forecasts?
Yeah, sure. So there's a few reasons why the tides can be higher than the forecast. All the tide forecasts are made, they can be made years in advance. So they don't have any knowledge of the current weather or the current ocean or any of those factors. And so those can combine to be quite a bit higher than the forecast. And that's what happened. We were about 1 foot higher than what the forecast were.
Yeah. How big of a miss is that?
It's not.
That sounds like a lot. 12 additional inches of water.
Sounds like a lot. That's on the larger end of misses.
Okay.
But it's not unheard of. Also, one of the factors that is not included, we have when we see those forecasts, they are using the average high tide level from the 1983 to 2001 timeframe. Those get updated about every 19 or 20 years, so we're about due for one. Well, what's happened since then is the sea level has risen, maybe 5 inches or so. So, some of that offset is just from that.
It's just higher seas.
Yeah.
Right. In
yeah.
that case, which is what the science needs to pick up on. And we'll talk about a little bit about that later. But what about the atmospheric conditions that added to that 12 extra inches of king tides?
Yeah. So there's a few things like the onshore winds, the how strong the atmospheric pressure is.
Mm-hmm.
So a lower pressure or higher pressure will influence the tides. But the main thing is just the strength of the onshore winds. And those were.
Did Lorenzo way out in the Atlantic Ocean, that big hurricane that we didn't have to pay any attention to, thankfully, but the forecasters did? Did that have any effect?
It looks like it may have, actually. On the peak day, which was October 1st, that was not predicted to be the highest tide. The highest tide was actually 2 days before that, based on the forecasts. So it kept coming up day after day. So the tide the next day was higher. Okay, that's odd. The tide on October 1st was higher still.
Yeah.
Like, okay, that's really odd.
Yeah.
And just so happens that on that day is when a lot of the swells and the basically a surge coming from the hurricane 2,500 miles away reached the entire East Coast.
Wow.
Of the United States.
Wow. Jane Gilbert, the Chief Resilience Officer with Miami, how did the Miami shoreline do with these higher than expected high tides?
Sure. So there were definitely some distinct neighborhoods that felt the impacts. One thing to remember with king tides is they do go out with the falling tide. So they last no more than about 3 hours. But we had several neighborhoods along our bay and actually in the Miami River that were impacted. The good news is very few of our major roads were impacted. There was a little flooding on 79th Street and in the Brickell Bay Drive area and South Bayshore Drive. But other than that, really, other than those real bay-impacted places, we were in good shape. Part of that is because, thankfully, due to the voters voting for Miami Forever Bond, we have been installing tidal valves, backflow prevention valves, that prevent the higher tidal waters from backing up through storm drains.
It's a one-way door. It allows the water to flow one way,
correct,
which is out to the bay. And when the bay rises, when the king tide comes, like Brian was just talking about,
right,
it doesn't allow those to come up, at least in those storm drains.
Right. But one of the things we learned through this higher than expected king tide was that we installed some in the Brickell Bay Drive area,
right,
for instance. But the tidal valves got caught, backflowed with some marine debris, and the ancillary infrastructure wasn't able to support it in such a way that it didn't function, and it's still flooded.
So
that's
a learning. So the one-way valve got caught open.
Is
that what happened?
It got caught open, and the pressure was such that it pushed up through the manhole covers.
Yeah.
So that was good learning for us as we plan to install 40 more and many more throughout the city so that we'll think that through.
So what's the lesson? How do you prevent that?
What
kind of debris are we talking about here?
You know, unfortunately, we have a lot of litter on our streets that end up in the storm drains.
And that's what it was. It was street litter, like plastic bottles,
correct,
or something along those lines. Okay.
Correct.
Yeah.
So in the future, we will make sure as we install the valves that we think about the ancillary infrastructure and make sure that those...
Does it raise the cost?
Slightly.
Slightly. How many zeros is slightly on the cost?
Or to be determined.
To be determined. Okay. Does it affect how many tidal valves you can put in? Does it reduce the number you can put in because of the higher
thankfully,
cost?
Thankfully, the state of Florida helped contribute $1.5 million mm-hmm. towards our tidal valves and the Miami Forever bond. So we're in good shape on installing valves where we need to install them.
Talking about King Tides, share your experiences with us. Maybe you drove through or you saw folks drive through it or you avoided them altogether. Your experiences from, say, 20 years ago, if you've been in South Florida for a good long time. 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. You can send us a text as well. That's 786-786-7636. The Chief Resilience Officer of the City of Miami is along with us, as well as a atmospheric science professor at the University of Miami is with us as well. Your questions about King Tide or resilience efforts in your neighborhood or your community. Inka in Key West is along with us on line one. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hi. I've lived in Key West for five generations. I am a conk down here, and the water has never been as high as it is until today when the tides come. And when the tides come, the baseball fields get flooded. The tourists down here think it must have rained, and it hasn't. And it's clear. The water is clear. It's pristine. It's coming up through the drain. Like if there was a water pipe, it just runs clear like a little river. And it just swarmed our whole streets down here. So you have people that have no clue about a king tide or, you know, just from different countries that are even living here. And they just drive straight through it. And the tourists, they just must have thought it must have rained really hard. Well, we all know that you don't drive through it. And sometimes when it's happening, we just stay home until the tides go down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a new car. I have a 2007 truck. And I've been saying, oh, I'm going to get a new truck when my house is completed with renovation. Well, now I'm like, there's no point. We're just going to keep getting higher and higher tides because when I bought my house, on Big Coppet, which is 10 miles out of Key West, mm-hmm. I would see the next door neighbors, like if they had a lower seawall, because it comes to concrete, you know, before you get on your boat or there's some wood there. And I would see the neighbor's house with the concrete like 3 inches over, and some had 6 inches over of high tide water. And mine was higher than theirs. Mm-hmm. And I would see their kids playing on it. And I was like, oh, that would be cool if we swam over and just sat. So, you know, you're not dangling your feet in a deep canal, it's dark. And it's just really cute. Then I started thinking, oh, that's nice. Well, this year, it's 6 inches over mine, and it never was before.
Yeah.
Never.
Inka, I appreciate that historical perspective there. And Brian McNulty with the University of Miami, you mentioned sea level rise and its influence in the king tides that we've been experiencing the past few days. I'm guessing you haven't sat down with your graph paper to figure out what that contribution necessarily has been. But anecdotally, when you hear stories like that from a fifth generation conk in Key West, as a scientist, what do you think about?
Well, that is absolutely true. And we know, at least around here, we've seen about 5 inches of sea level rise in the last 25 years or so. So that's something that you can notice when something is very close to a level that you can see with your eye, like, you know, your wall out back. Mm-hmm. It gives you a good reference point to see what a difference 5 inches makes. And that's just since the, you know, like 1994, 95 time frame. Certainly, if you go back further than that, it's been more than 5 inches. So all other things being equal, just the sea level rise by itself has added that much.
Has added, and then add the additional king tide on top of that 5 inches, and we get some experiences like we've seen this week.
That's right.
Yeah. And so, Jane, is your job is to plan for that. How do you begin to incorporate the 5 inches that we already see, let alone the sea level rise that we're still expecting to see as you're looking at your one-way tidal valves and raising streets and putting pumps in, either permanent pumps or, in the case of this week, like we saw, some temporary pumps put in?
Absolutely. The city is right now in the process of updating its stormwater master plan, taking sea level rise into account. So we're in the process of creating a prioritized list of capital infrastructure that looks at sea level rise over the short, medium, and long term, and what measures we need to put in now, what we need to plan to put in 20 years, and what we need to plan to put in 40 years.
And what is the sea level rise basis for those different time
horizons?
So
we are using an actual just firm number of inches, because the predictions for sea level rise are shifting over time.
Mm-hmm. They're getting
and
higher.
They're getting higher, and our model, we can always shift it with the model, but right now we're looking at both 18 inches and 30 inches. So that gives us a
over
good,
what time frame?
Again, that could happen mm-hmm. over a 20 to 40 to 50 year time frame.
Okay. Yeah.
And it could happen over 60 years. We don't know yet.
Right.
But we're using those hard numbers that we know we can plan for.
Yep.
And that will prioritize our list of projects with the Miami Forever Bond.
When you see the experiences that residents have had to deal with this week with the high tides, historic high tides, top five high tides, I think, that we've seen here in South Florida, and know that there's going to be some more in 3.5 weeks and some more even then after that. And you look at the planning and the spending and the infrastructure investments that the Miami Forever Bond is allowing. Is it changing the types of infrastructure planning? In other words, you talk about some of the infrastructure around the one-way tidal valves because of your experience with debris in the water. But what about some other resilience project that, as you've experienced this week, you've thought we may need to go revisit that kind of idea?
I would not say we're revisiting, but we do learn from every experience. So right now we're installing a new drainage project in Fairview and Coconut Grove. We're doing design demonstration projects in Brickell Bay Drive and Jose Marti Park. Those will be inform our future mm-hmm. plans. And we want to be a learning organization because this is about adaptive management. The other piece of this is that it's not just about infrastructure, right? It's mm-hmm. about preparing people. Our mm-hmm. listener from Key West mm-hmm. said some really important things, which is we have communications out to all our residents and businesses, letting them know when to expect king tides, and specifically targeting the neighborhoods where we see are going to be most impacted, so they know not to drive through those waters or even to, you know, walk through the waters mm-hmm. and can know that they can look at the tidal times and expect to know when those will go down again. We feel it's real important. We also want to engage our residents in actually monitoring and observing the impacts. So we have at MiamiGov King Tides, we have a flood reporting form that people can submit, and that will actually help inform our stormwater master plan, as well as partnering with Florida International University on their Sea Level Solutions Day.
So you obviously that information important for the public to know about, to plan for, but for those residents that see it in their front yard, to see it creeping closer to their foundation, for instance, or that they can't get to their driveway, it goes well beyond just knowing that the high water is coming.
Yes, of course. And that's where we also try to provide them information on what they can do to adapt their properties.
Give us an idea of what some of those are that you've seen played out in the last week.
Elevating seawalls, elevating the land property, as well as
it's hardening,
putting up putting up barriers at the entrance of their homes if they need to.
Yeah. Simon in Miami on line 3. Go ahead, Simon. You're on the radio. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you for having me on. I just want to say quick, if you kind of take an overlook of everything, you know, us Miamians here, we understand that we have king tides. You know, we do have hurricanes. We're prone to flooding. You know, but the sad reality is that nobody's thinking 100 years ahead when, you know, it is going to be an inch, you know, sea rise, and then Miami's going to be gone. And
Simon, are you still with us? Do we lose you?
150 years ahead. Hello?
Yeah, sorry. Where are you? Go ahead. You're making the point about a long time horizon looking into the next century.
Yeah, long term. You know, everybody's thinking 20 years, 30 years. What about in 100 years? You know, the fact is a fact, and it's already been, in the last 30 years, 5 inches of sea level rise?
Yeah.
You know, that's insane.
Yeah.
You know, I'm already making plans to leave Miami because I know that it's not going to be here when, you know, my kids are you know, my age. And that's the sad fact.
And is it the climate? Is it the seas that are pushing you out, Simon, or something else?
I'm not a scientist. You know, life is two things, logic and mathematics. And the logic right now is that, you know, we all got to really get prepared to start moving, you know, infrastructure, things that can really destroy our environment out of areas like Miami. Like, let's say junkyards. Yeah. You know, we have large piles of garbage in Doral. You know, what if when the sea hits that, what kind of contamination, you know, is going to occur for the rest of the people in the world?
Simon,
I'm really about the 100, 150-year plan. Everybody's thinking 20, 30 years, you know?
You're a long-term investor then, as the case may be, but someone who's looking to kind of sell Miami. Jane Gilbert, the Chief Resiliency Officer, how about, you know, what you hear there from Simon and the idea of...
Yeah, and we hear that question with some frequency about what is our 2100 plan, and really it's challenging for a city to,
and that's only 80 years away,
to think 80 years right. or 100 or 150 years out. We had a experts workshop last night for our stormwater master plan, and one of the questions was, can the model look at an even longer term scenario so that then as we think of short, medium, and long term solutions, we keep that long term scenario in mind? And I think that was a good suggestion. I think, you know, we are planning now for infrastructure that we expect to last for 40 to 50 years. You don't want to plan for infrastructure that you're not going to need until 60 years from now because it'll be obsolete by then. Mm-hmm. So it's really planning within the predictability horizon we can plan for and within the life cycle of our infrastructure.
And I think one of the concerns you also heard from Simon there was, you know, in the difficulty of planning for 60 years, putting infrastructure in, you may not need that infrastructure in part because of technology, but also because the land may be inhospitable for how it's being used.
There are a lot of things we can't predict that could happen.
yes, that we can. That is true.
Beyond 40, you know, even 10 years out, but let alone
what
40, 50.
How are you thinking about managed retreat here, which is has been a phrase that even the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has been talking about, and we've seen that play out in the Midwest with repetitive flood areas, but it's been very reluctant part of the conversation here in South Florida, in part because our highest value property is the property on the water.
Yes. So as part of that stormwater master plan, we are doing that cost-benefit analysis of all those investments related to what's the property and residents that we would be able to protect. Mm-hmm. So once we get that completed, which we expect will be late 2020, that will give us a lot more robust information about where we need to make some hard decisions about land use planning and working with our residents on incentives for making some choices to be in safer ground.
What are some of the inputs going into that calculation, that study? Is it the future value of the real estate?
Well, that'll
be tax base. Sure. That's foundational.
And number of residents, people.
The density.
The density.
Yeah. Well, but our access has got to be one too, right? The ability to get in and out. I mean, we've seen that
absolutely
in Brickell Bay with some new developments that have built higher than elevation, and the buildings are high and dry, but obviously the roads are not.
Right.
Yeah. Brian, meantime, what are we? 3.5 weeks, 4 weeks away from another king tide.
Yeah.
What's that one look like?
We're about 3 weeks out. The one in late October, it looks like the worst dates will be roughly the 26th through 29th or so, plus or minus. Mm-hmm. And it should be comparable to this one. It's hard to predict, you know, the individual wind components that week, but it could be comparable to what we just had.
Comparable to what we just had in terms of what we actually experienced or what the tide tables told us what was going to happen?
It's comparable in terms of what the tide forecast is.
Okay.
So will we remain a foot over that has yet to be seen, but we could.
Where did we see some impacts beyond the coastline? Did we see impacts beyond the coastline? Up the Miami River, up some of the canals, those areas? Jane?
Yes, absolutely. In some of the communities along the Miami River, we saw impacts.
Yeah, and impacts that they hadn't experienced in the past, for instance, or?
At least impacts that I hadn't seen before.
Okay, yeah. Jane Gilbert, the Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Miami. Brian McNulty is an atmospheric professor at the University of Miami. Both of you, thanks for joining us on the round. Appreciate it. Nice to hear from
you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
We got more to come on the roundup here in regards to the South Florida environment. A new United Nations report showing a kind of a bleak future for the world's oceans. We'll talk about what South Florida could lose from the impacts of climate change in the ocean. That's next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Much of life in South Florida revolves around water. Our ports and harbors depend on the ocean, certainly. Our beaches bring in hundreds of thousands, tens of millions of tourists each year. And a new report out recently by the United Nations finds that oceans around the world are in trouble. More than 100 scientists from 36 countries worked on this report put out by the International Panel on Climate Change. Carbon emissions from human activities are putting a dire strain on ocean health. Well, WLRN asked folks around South Florida this week about what the ocean means to them.
My name is Juliana Velez. I live in Miami, and I am just a ocean lover. Since I've lived in Miami, I've always decided to live close to the water, close to the ocean. I wake up, I look at it. That's kind of like my reference point. That's how I check the weather. I'm an avid scuba diver. And I mainly do scuba diving only with sharks. So I am concerned about sharks, and I am concerned about our ecosystem.
This is photographer Ben Hicks in Boca Raton, Florida. Our livelihood and our climate is impacted by our decisions. The planet is taking the impact, especially over the last 100 years. Tons of plastics are spread across the world in our seas, being ingested by all organisms. Action is essential now.
Ben also worked on WLRN Television's new documentary that premiered on Thursday this week called Troubled Waters, A Turtle's Tale. It looked at the state of the environment through the eyes of sea turtles. You can watch the documentary this Sunday night, 9 o'clock, on WLRN Television, Channel 17. WLRN's environmental reporter, Jenny Stiletovich, is with us. Also in studio is Dr. Martin Grossell, a marine biologist at the University of Miami. We want to hear from you, your experiences with the ocean. What does it mean to you, the Atlantic Ocean here in Miami? What's your experience with it? How has it influenced your life? 800-743-9576. What are your questions about marine life or the ocean health? What changes have you experienced maybe as a fisherman, a scuba diver, a snorkeler? 800-743-WLRN or the text line 786-786-7636. Again, text us your first name where you're texting from at 786-786-7636. Dr. Grossell, first of all, how would you describe the health of the ocean here in South Florida?
Well, I think it depends a little on the scale you're considering. I know currently Florida Bay is not in the best state. And, you know, whether that's strictly related to climate change is uncertain. I think many factors are contributing. I think the impression is probably less bleak or severe if you're considering a wider perspective geographically. Mm-hmm. But as the recent report clearly documents, there are global impacts to marine life and ocean health, and we're certainly seeing that in Florida as well.
What are the concerns that you have as a scientist for ocean health in South Florida?
So South Florida, probably the biggest concern, well, there's two factors. There's temperature and there's CO2, and they're related. So the elevated CO2 in the atmosphere will equilibrate with oceans, and that causes a reduction in pH.
CO2 is carbon.
Exactly. Yeah. And that reduction in pH will have implications directly for fish, and we can talk about the details of that.
This is the chemistry of the ocean you're talking about here.
That's
in
right.
In terms of pH and the acidification.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that impacts the animals that are living in it directly in the case of fish, but also indirectly by affecting their habitat. And you know, it's a very complex situation. The direct impacts on fish are related to the change in chemistry within them that's caused by the change in chemistry in the oceans.
Yeah.
Some of the indirect impacts relate to the change in their habitat. So, for example, coral reefs in the Florida region are under a lot of stress. And as you know, coral reefs serve as a habitat for marine life, including a lot of fish species.
And Jenny Stiletovich, we've seen those reefs under stresses, and the stress is growing because of the acidification that the professor talks about. Water temperatures rising as well. With this UN report that looked at ocean health globally, think about it locally. And you've covered the environment here. What did you pull out of that? What are the concerns that you see the environmental community really focused on here locally when it comes to ocean
right.
health?
So one of the things that Martin and I talked about a few minutes ago is that systems that are already under stress because of pollution, overdevelopment, when you add this extra level of climate change impacts, they're really suffering. And so you have, for example, reefs that have been battling bleaching events, have been battled, you know, increased boat trafficking and pollution. And suddenly you have increased ocean temperatures because of climate change, or you have increased acidification because they're sucking up more carbon, then they're less prepared. They're suffering even more.
Yeah.
So that was one point, sorry. And the second point is that this report noted that these changes were projected, but what surprised them is that they're accelerating. Yeah. They're happening faster than they expected.
800-743-9576, our voice line. Your questions about marine health, ocean health here in South Florida, your experiences. Share what you've experienced over the years as a fisherman or a snorkeler, a diver. 786-786-7636 is the text line. 786-786-7636. Now, Lisa, in Miami on line one, go ahead. You are on the radio. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. Thank you for having me. My question is relating to UV. I remember growing up in Miami, and now the UV is much higher than other places with sunlight, like California and Hawaii. And I believe that is access to construction and development across the board. And there's a lot of talk here on how government is trying to prevent this, you know, rise in sea level. And my question was, aren't there preventative or regulatory measures to know what actually goes up? Like, there's a bunch of new condos on Biscayne Bay that are being flooded. And is there a coincidence that the inner cities that are being gentrified are the only areas above water?
So lots to unpack there, Nalisa. Thank you. Lots in that very short comment there. First, let me get to the effect of ultraviolet rays. Has UV changed over the years here in South Florida? What's that influence on the health of the ocean?
Let me first say that's somewhat out of my area of expertise.
Okay, fair enough.
But as I understand it, yes, there is more intense UV radiation that affects us, obviously, but also marine organisms.
Yeah. And then Nalisa's point, I think, was talking about real estate development to some degree, Jenny Stiletovich, and the ocean front and kind of the ability for developers to continue to maximize the value of that. And that's what South Florida has been built on for three, four generations now.
Right. And I think going forward, city planners, that's Jane mentioned that they're going to be addressing that and find areas where the cost benefit analysis doesn't support continuing to build flood walls or they're going to need those areas for natural barriers. I mean, that is something that the city zoning code or the county zoning code, the building code, how you build these structures is probably going to have to address.
Yeah. 800-743-9576. Elon in Fort Lauderdale on line two. Go ahead, Elon. You're on the radio now.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that calling in from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and I'm in the yachting industry. So our industry depends enormously on the health of the oceans. And over the years, I've been doing this 6-7 years now, and I've seen a huge decline in sea life population and the amount of trash that I pick up from the waters. And I can't imagine what this industry will look like 10-20 years from now if we don't start to do something about the quality of our water and the waterways we have in South Florida.
Yeah, Elon, appreciate that. Certainly the yachting industry and the yachting maintenance industry here is a multi-billion-dollar business, which relies, of course, on the marine industry directly. I mean, it's literally right there, and Elon's perspective is important. Dr. Grossel, though, I'm curious as to when you hear concerns such as Elon expressing, what are the efforts that you and your colleagues that look at this are advising regulatory agencies, or frankly, are just scratching your head, pulling your hair out to say these are things that could be done?
I mean, I think the advice, and it's in the report very clearly, is that you need to limit CO2 or carbon emissions. I mean, that, you know, that has to happen, and it has to happen fast and to a very large extent for things not to to deteriorate.
Let me pause you right there, because this IPCC UN report discussed to some degree the effect of that. And for instance, around sea level rise, it spoke about sea level rise is accelerating, and that it will, this is a quote, sea level will continue to rise for centuries. It could reach around 11 to 23 inches by 2100, even if greenhouse gas emissions are sharply reduced and global warming is limited.
This is correct. And those are sort of very bleak predictions, obviously. And that's if we stop emissions or we halt increase in emission at, you know, today, basically.
Yeah. And not, by the way, by we, it's not the United States.
No, it's by we, I mean
globally,
all of us, globally,
right.
Yes. Yeah. However, you got to look at that in the context of if we continue with business as usual. If that's the case, I believe the sea level rise at the end of the century will be in the order of 3 feet. So while it may seem that this is perhaps already to some extent a lost cause, that's certainly not the case. There's still a lot that can be done.
Will it still be in a hospitable ocean for the marine life that call it home?
Well, but that's the other thing. If we're considering the scenario where we have a 3 feet sea level rise, that is associated with a massive acidification as well. It's associated with temperature rise. That's actually what's causing the sea level rise. It's associated with stratification, so less mixing in the oceans, yeah, which means a reduced production, reduced fisheries landings, reduced biomasses, and reduced biodiversity in our oceans. So the questions that this caller posed, you know, to get back to that, no, I mean, things would continue to decline significantly.
Yeah. One of the points in this UN report also, Jenny Stiletovich, was talking about heat waves, which we're very familiar with on shore here in South Florida, but heat waves underwater, which many of us may not have been so much aware, and the effect, the bad effect that those heat waves can have.
Right. I didn't know that much about them, and
right?
I didn't know that they were occurring at an accelerating rate, which is what they determined. There's a well-known one in the Pacific, but what they're finding is that they're occurring not just more often, but they're lasting longer.
Yeah.
And when that happens, fish move.
Yeah, they don't like the hot water, just like any of us. Coconut Grove up next. Juan, you're on line 4. Go ahead. You're on the radio now.
Hey, how are you guys? I want to ask a question regarding the swimming advisory by the Miami-Dade County. That this has been happening over and over since summer. We are the Florida Ocean Cleanup Society. We mm-hmm. have a nonprofit organization, and we pick up plastics, and we're dealing with, you know, we're doing cleanups and big cleanups and beach cleanups, but we have another organization in Miami called Miami Waterkeeper, who is tracking the quality of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And every week we see how swimming advisories, it's happening more and more often. Obviously, it's affecting human life, but it's also affecting animals.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say really quick that on July 3rd, we were doing an after-school sailing program on the Biscayne Bay, and we saw a baby wild dolphin giving birth on the Biscayne Bay. So we were really lucky. The kids love it, but we're really worried because all of a sudden now we're going out and we cannot even swim out there on the bay, and it's becoming the new normal.
Juan, you bring up a great point. Let me put it to the professor here. The swimming ban or swimming advisories, we because we're egocentric species, we think about that from the human perspective, but what about from the marine life that don't have the opportunity not to go to the ocean that day?
Yeah, I mean, it is a concern for marine life. We've all heard about harmful algae blooms, for example, and the fish kills that are associated with that. And if anyone is wondering whether this is related to climate change, I can say it is. Climate change is not the only factor responsible for increased frequencies of these events, but it is a contributing factor along with increased concentrations of nutrients in the coastal waters.
And I'm working on a story today. I talked to a water quality scientist. This occurrence of the king tide and the swimming advisories are not, it's not a coincidence that you had king tides, high tides, and followed by advisories about the quality in the water.
Diane in Cooper City, I've got literally just a few seconds here, but I know you got a quick perspective you want to share with us. Go ahead.
Right. I'm a flight attendant, and I have noticed in the last probably 10, 15 years how these lines of yellow scum are appearing, not just on the Florida coast, but around the islands, to the Caribbean islands, and who knows where it's coming from, probably illegal dumping, but I won't swim anymore in Florida waters.
Diana, perspective from 40,000 feet there as a flight attendant in Cooper City. Thanks for that perspective there. Jenny Stiletovich covering the environment at WLRN. Nice to have you. Thanks for sharing the reporting. And Dr. Martin Grossell, a professor at the University of Miami. Professor, thanks for your time as well. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Our program is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Our digital director is Teresa Furtado. WLRN's news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. The director of radio operations, Peter Merritt. The director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting WLRN. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.